performing from colleges we've performed at, letters from individuals, juveniles, and so on, which I, of course, won't take the time to read, but mm-hmm. I can use them as reference, and, you know, I can document whatever I have to say
right.
in that regard.
Now, I will come back to you during the break, so that if you feel that we need to go into another direction, or if you have some ideas or some suggestions, we can discuss them then, okay?
Yeah, good. Now, I've got a good research file here on just about, as Ed related, there are some questions, pointed questions about statistics and figures.
Right.
Well, I've got the congressional record, United States Department of Justice report, syndicated wire service reports, editorials from Wall Street Journal, things like that.
Okay. Now, I don't want to throw you a curve, but everything will depend upon how you and I relate. I may not ask any of the questions.
Uh-oh.
Okay?
Well, we're ready, whatever you ask.
Right, thank
we're
you.
We're ready.
All right, the next time I'll be talking, we'll be on the air. Stand by.
All right.
This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, reforming our prisons and our prisoners. Tonight's guest, ex-con Rick Clusi. He served a term in San Quentin for kidnapping. Now he's a social critic and prison reformer. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. The first thing I'd do is tear down the walls, throw away the barbed wire, and take away the guns, unquote. These are the words of Rick Clusi, a former inmate of San Quentin, now social critic and reformer, talking about prisons, those institutions that remove a man from society as punishment for a crime against society. But the question is, after you've removed a person from society, which in itself might be considered punishment enough, just what do you do with him? Should we spend the taxpayers' money in re-educating and rehabilitating him so that he may become a possible asset to society? Or do we treat him like an unwanted child and give him overcrowded accommodations, miserable food, and tough weaponed guards to remind him that there is a thick brick wall between him and society? Our guest calling in tonight from San Francisco, California, is Rick Clusi to answer your questions on prisons and prisoners and the task of rehabilitating the men behind the bars. Mr. Clusi, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dale.
And thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to a lot of good questions tonight.
In our opening, Mr. Clusi, we said that, we're quoting you, that the first thing you'd do would be to tear the walls down, throw away the barbed wire, and take away the guns. How could you possibly do this with men who have been held behind bars for any length of time, where we can assume that there's a certain amount of hostility, at the same time where we've been told that more than 80% of the men who are incarcerated are repeats?
Well, I think that perhaps I've been quoted out of context there, Del. What I mean by tearing down the walls, taking away the barbed wire and the guns, the gas chambers, and all the punitive aspects of our rehabilitation centers today, is that we can reach people better, and we can by treating them more humane initially. So that what happens if we tear down the walls, we replace them with glass, aluminum structures, plenty of light, and we replace the guards with medical technicians and trained staff, and we take away the punitive aspect of what we are doing and try to treat people, because in my opinion, and I think this is the crux of it, anyone who is incarcerated or commits a crime, there is a reason for it, and that reason is rooted in a, well, in a sickness. That it's like a child stealing a hubcap, or it's like then he graduates to something bigger, and we just keep going up the ladder. There, people have to be treated for this, and I don't think our prisons, our dumping grounds, if you will, are serving this need today.
Mr. Clusi, could you tell us what life is like in prison?
Well, I can only tell you what life was like for me in nearly 12 years. Well, I would say that the prison experience militates against any kind of constructive, productive, emotionally sound life after one is released from it, because all of the factors that bear upon one inside the walls are negative factors. You see, even the aspect of being placed in a cell or being placed in a closed area with a wall around you, and then have people with who wear badges walking around, all of this is a constant negation of values. There's nothing positive about the prison atmosphere. So that one would hope, I suppose, if a man were to be rehabilitated, that he could better be rehabilitated in an atmosphere more suitable toward rehabilitation. So that here we have at San Quentin, the prison I speak of, in the shadow of the wall, a gas chamber. Daily we walk by that to our work assignments. Not that we could see it, but we knew that there were 80 or 90 men up there who were going to be executed, legally executed. And this is a demoralizing effect upon people, has a demoralizing effect.
There's a feeling in the country that the law is too lenient with people. There's a feeling from some sociologists and some critics that perhaps that the law should become a little bit more stringent. And you're stating now that we need a new approach to the whole system of prisons. Where can we get together with these two opposite opinions?
Well, I don't propose to have that answer, Del, but in my opinion, I think that basically, and this is a quote from a man that I met at San Quentin, that all of the laws in the world are not going to be any guarantee of individual freedom or of social freedoms. That in effect, most laws after a while tend to militate against individual freedom and social freedom. I'm not talking about justice. I'm talking about freedom. And that if, as a basic rule, if we were to reach out to the good in people, even the people we have in our prisons today, reach out for that good, foster that good, approve that good, then simply if we do not, someone else will exploit the bad in those people. And I think that's what it characterizes the prison experience per se, is the effect of the wall, the effect of the barbed wire, the effect of the gas chambers, the militancy and the posture of punitive measures that, you know, the guards represent, are all negative values. And I keep repeating myself in that regard, but I can't stress it. It's such a basic point that we simply must reach out to the good. I don't think you're going to get together with the dissident groups in the country today, law or no law, until we all start regarding each other as people with equal rights, with equal values, and then I think that's openers.
According to our research, you spent 8 years in prison.
12.
12 years, I'm sorry. And during that time, you did not break one rule.
Well, yeah, that's what they said in the newspaper when I came out, right?
And according to the warden, James W. L. Park, he says that it was really doing something considering how many rules we've got around here. Does this not give us the feeling or the impression that you're not just an average individual?
Well, I suppose it would give one that impression, but my personal feeling is that although I didn't break any of the rules, my whole attitude, my whole desire during those years was to better myself, not at the expense of any of my relationships with the fellow inmates, you see. I didn't walk around there as a goody-goody. I mean, in other words, I never turned over on anybody or snitched on anybody. I just did my thing, and I was respected by the other guys in the joint for it. My thing was learning, trying to improve myself as an individual. I completed school, and I spent about 10 years in the theater workshop over there, in which I was fortunate enough to write a play called The Cage. So that I wasn't concentrating on breaking rules. I was concentrating on improving myself. And I think the two go together.
Well, now, in the writing of the play, The Cage, was this part of the rehabilitation program that you were involved in?
Yes, it was part of it in that we had a prison workshop, a drama workshop, and that in a period of 10 years, we produced 35 plays over there. We did some world premieres. We did some United States premieres. We did some California premieres. We did theater that came to us from Europe and that hadn't been done here outside of the wall, I should say, yet. We didn't have to pay any royalties or anything like this, so theater, any play that was printed was available to us. And our only limitation was that the cast had to conform to an all-male status. But the part of the rehabilitation program is true. The state allowed us to conduct the workshop program, and I'd say in the course of the 10 years that maybe close to 1,000 inmates participated in it, and some of them with very, very good results, because one man that I can think of now is part of our theater group today here in San Francisco, which we call the Barbed Wire Theater, came out of prison, was given a scholarship to the American Conservatory Theater. He later worked with the Actors Workshop here in San Francisco. He just completed a movie with Woody Allen, Please Don't Drink the Water, beg your pardon, Take the Money and Run, and he's done very well, so that we have had some graduates of our group, and we're presently reaching out to all parts of the country to try to bring some of these alumni back so that we can use them in the Barbed Wire Theater, man.
Do you see your play as a tool to bring about prison reforms?
I do, Del, I do. But, you know, it's another way. It's not a it's not a vehicle to demonstrate, you know, the exact values, or say, of being in a cage. It is the subterranean world of that cage. It's the emotion as it screams out. I say that I think my play is a protest against the dehumanization of man by his fellow man. And my work with it was conceived not in any sense of a rebellion, but in the hope that its worth, that its force, that it would be, could be intrinsically brought to bear on those who saw it. And somehow through the association that the intellect can perhaps understand a little better the futility, the emotional chaos, the ultimate degradation, the violence, the underlying facts of life and death confronting all people who find themselves caged.
Why do most people who have not had any experience with former inmates or the law period, really, why do they seem to just outwardly reject people who've been involved with prisons?
I think that there's a... that there is most likely a psychiatric basis for that kind of emotion. I think that there's something down deep in all of us that wants that cage, you know, and that's afraid to admit it. And that the sort of puritanical dimensions of our heritage here, and I suppose why so many people fled the continent and came to America and founded it to begin with, because of the oppressiveness of those countries, of that time. So that when we came to America, we all were like, you know, man, we were looking for some kind of justice. We were looking for some kind of freedom and some independence. And well, I think in an underlying way that we brought a lot of that anxiety with us. And it manifests itself by, you know, the social equation, the looking at the status quo. You know, I mean, I'm driving a Cadillac or I'm driving a Ford, and this poor guy is in prison, man, you know, so thumbs down on him.
Have you had problems seeking employment or getting employed since you've been released?
No. I came out and I went to work for the Seven Step Foundation, which, as you might know, or the listening audience would be interested in, that is a group of former offenders who have gathered together to make conditions better for people who come out of prison. And there are various chapters of the Seven Step Foundation around the country today. There's something like six or seven states involved in it. It's a nonprofit movement. It was started by Bill Sands, who wrote a book. And I worked with them for 18 months. I'm out 2 years now, and I worked for them for 18 months. And for the past 6 months, I have been working on my own project, The Cage, the Barbed Wire Theater Program. And we're going to bring the show back to Washington in June to do it for the Health, Education, and Welfare Department, a big conference at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. And we're going to give two performances back there for all the agency people, and a lot of people in Washington who I hope will see it will come away with the feeling that here are a bunch of guys who, you know, have served the time and who have lived the kind of life that are devoid of values and devoid of any kind of feeling for other people, who can now come out, can be reborn, can resurrect themselves, and can stand on their own two feet and do something creatively. And we want to reach out primarily to a younger audience, Del, although we feel that there's a lot of, you know, this climate in our colleges, our universities today, a lot of agitation, a lot of problems. I think that our play can be the beginning of some understanding, some basis for understanding. But moreover, the importance of a dialogue with these people. Now, here, we've got guys in the play right now, 3 years in Synanon. We've got a director of the Seven Step Foundation involved in it. I'm involved in it. We've got a black cat man who's real beautiful, came out of Quentin here about a year and a half ago, is already off of his parole status, and has founded a program called SATE, S-A-T-E, Self-Advancement Through Education. He's also in the play. So when you get five or six guys with a combined experience of 50 years in prison standing up on a stage after we've given them this show, and we spend the next hour in dialogue with them talking about drug addiction, talking about alcoholism, talking about recidivism, talking about some of the problems of sick people, talking about the black cat's role in prison, the black cat's role in society. You know, I think we're now reaching out to people. We're trying to give them the basis of our expertise.
I'm going to read just a brief line from a review of your play by Gene Miller. I'm sorry I don't have the newspaper where this was taken from, but she quotes former warden Clinton T. Duffy, and Mr. Duffy is quoted as saying, "I think curiosity will be a prime factor in bringing people into the theater. Everyone is fascinated by the prospect of seeing ex-convicts in the flesh." Does this seem something like a sideshow kind of thing? That, you know, that what is so curious, or what is the fascination in seeing ex-convicts?
I think it's the obvious polarity, Del, in that, look, here the bad guys, and I'm a good guy, you know? That's my role, see? I can come and I can look at them, I can look down my nose at them, or I can look at them in terms of curiosity. But I'll guarantee you that after the people see this show and talk with us, that they will leave there with a different attitude. And we saw it here in San Francisco, and we saw it in the colleges we went to, and we've seen it in the communities we played at. It's there, man. People come with a sense of curiosity. People come, for many reasons. But rather than get into that bag too deep, I think they come because they want to change their attitude. They want to really know what it is like in a prison. And they feel the only way they can get away from it, to get closer to it, is by talking to cats who've had the experience.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation is reforming our prisons and our prisoners. And our guest calling in from San Francisco tonight is Mr. Rick Clucci, who served a term in San Quentin for kidnapping. Now he's a social critic and prison reformer. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Clucci, and we'll begin taking phone calls right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest ex-con prison reformer Rick Clucci after station identification.
The most obvious symbols of today's affluent society are the outdoor barbecue and the sports car. The most incongruous is the rat. According to the 1960 census, more than 4 million urban dwellings were completely dilapidated. 3 million more were badly deteriorated. And another 2 million had serious code violations or were overcrowded. If building codes were enforced, most ghetto buildings would be boarded up. During the 1930s, we saved the farms from starvation. Now the cities need help before they die of neglect. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder.
Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest Rick Clucci, ex-convict turned prison reformer. He says you've got to reform the prisons before you can really reform the prisoners. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we'll take our first call tonight from Newark, New Jersey. Mr. Robinson is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, hello, Rick.
Yes, hello, Mr. Robinson.
Oh, how are you?
Fine, sir.
I would like to ask you, for one thing, where is San Quentin?
San Quentin is located in Marin County, which is on San Francisco Bay, approximately 12 and a half to 13 miles from San Francisco.
Yeah. Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
I think your radio is on, and you would help us very much if you would turn it down.
Yeah, there it is.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is everything all right now?
Yeah.
Yes, it is, sir. Thank you.
Okay, now I want to ask you, at San Quentin, do they keep the prison up as far as cleanliness is concerned?
Yeah, well, there's a certain effort to do that, but it's a very old physical plant. You dig?
Well, tell me, how old is the prison?
There's no hot water in the cells. That gives you an idea how old it is.
Oh, I see.
It was built in 1852.
What year?
1852, right, sir.
Well, tell me, has there been any remodels or has there been any additions since then?
Yeah, they put what they call an adjustment center into the prison. They tore down the oldest existing structure, which was a Spanish cell block. Used in former times to house the Spanish prisoners and so on. And they tore it down. They built on its site a what they call an adjustment center, which is, in effect, a prison within a prison.
Oh, I see. Now, tell me, out at San Quentin where you were for 12 years, do they have mostly black...
2.5 years at San Quentin, a year and a half in the county jail on trial and appeal.
I see. Now, tell me, how long was your sentence for?
Life without possibility of parole.
Oh, well, tell me, what made it possible for you to have parole?
Governor Brown commuted my sentence.
That's the governor of California?
To allow me a possibility of parole.
Yes, I see. Well, tell me, how long do you have parole?
I'm on a life parole.
Oh, from now until you'll be on parole.
Yeah, I figure in about 6 more years I can break it down, though.
Yes, I see. Now tell me, at San Quentin, is there mostly black people there or white people, or how is it as far as immigration?
2% of the population of the prison is black.
Oh, the population
is
primarily black.
About 18 to 20% are brown. Mm-hmm. The rest are Caucasian, less 2%, which is Oriental.
Mm-hmm, I see.
The majority of your prisons in America, sir, are black. Most prisons. That's one way we solve the problem.
Yeah, I see. Well, tell me, what is the major and the biggest improvement that you think the prisons can make? The biggest improvement that would really change most prisons?
Well, take the punitive aspect out of them. We can leave the physical plants for last. They can go down last, but we can start by replacing the guards with trained medical technicians, psychiatric staff, social workers, psychologists.
Yeah, people that would try to understand the people's problems.
Yeah, vocational training, trades. I mean, put all the emphasis on that. Schools. If we're going to elevate the second-class citizens in this country, we can't do it with walls, barbed wire, gas chambers, and all of that jazz. We've got to start doing it by getting a little light into those joints.
Yes, I can understand that point. Yes, I understand what you mean. I do agree with you, and you sound like a very sensible individual. I can't see how you were able you were up for kidnapping?
Yeah, kidnapping and robbery, and during the course of the robbery, I shot the man, and it was by accident, and he didn't die or anything, but called the little Lindbergh law out here, and that's the ultimate penalty is death, and that's what Chessman got. And the alternate sentence is life without possibility of parole. That's what I got.
Yeah.
I was 20 years old.
You're 20?
I was 20 then.
Oh, you were 20.
Yeah.
So so that would make you 32 now.
Yeah, I. No. I'm 35 now. I've been out 2 years.
Oh yeah, that's right. You've been out 2 years. Okay, well, anyway, I wish you a lot of success while
Thank
you're
you.
Out. Success and happiness, and do enjoy your holidays. This is Ernest Robinson calling up from Newark, New Jersey.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay,
thank you for calling.
Now.
Thank you. Out to New Orleans, Mr. McCann is hearing Night Call over WDSU. Mr. McCann?
Hello, Mr. Cozy.
Hello, Mr. McCann.
I'm very interested in your statements, and as was a reporter once, I'm a lawyer now. And, at the time I was with reporter, I got vastly interested in the criminal and the men in the penitentiaries in various parts of the country. So I was being visited, as a newspaper man. And I finally I was able to get through to reach you. In other words, you had to play any game. I actually made it very clear that I was not the authority in any way. I wasn't talking for the warden or anybody else. I was just, I was sincerely interested. And I finally got through. It's tough, but what I found, and I don't know whether you can confirm this or not, that there is a small percentage of men that I call congenital criminals that nobody's going to have a change in. Maybe not congenital, I don't know, but that's the only definition I could think of.
Yes, well, I'd say whatever the percentage of those kind of people there are, and I've certainly ran into a few of them in my experience, I would say that if we stop spending, I think, what is it, something like, 200 million or $200 billion or $81 billion a year on keeping people locked up with something like only 200 million in training them and trying to resurrect them, that we could reconvert even that small number of what you call habitual criminals.
You think they could be reconverted?
Yeah, I definitely think they
could. But, of course, you spent more time with them.
They have to be housed in a situation, in an atmosphere, and they have to be treated like sick people because they are sick people. We don't treat polio victims in any other way, but with the best medical treatment we can, the best scientific knowledge we have. So why should we treat people who have a social problem, in any other way?
That's
I think
correct.
We're 200 years behind ourselves. We got rocket shots
on the moon,
and we got places in Arkansas where they dig up the backyard and we got bones.
Yeah, well, I used to be on the newspaper in Arkansas. You know that, but I want you to know that I am sincere in it because even as a lawyer, I still go down and work on the prison right here.
Yeah.
You know, with the rehabilitation program.
Good man. Keep it up.
And the men respond remarkably well to it.
I
know a little bit about how to talk to them.
Well, try a little kindness. Try a little tenderness.
I know how to talk to them.
There you go.
I have no trouble with it. My trouble is wanting to take the case back to court.
Mr. McCann,
I enjoy very much. Gentleman that's conducting this program is extremely nice, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Crucci, I just want to ask a couple of questions since we had discussed this subject somewhat a few months back in the area of prison reform. Out in California, as a former inmate, are you permitted to own an automobile? Can you drive an automobile? Can you own property?
With permission.
Can you own property?
With permission, right. In other words, in order to enter into a contract, I have to have the permission of the adult authority. If I wanted to rent a place, they waive that. In other words, I don't have to ask them just to be able to rent a place. But if I'm going to buy a place, which involves a certain amount of transaction with the bank, a certain amount of civil rights, shall we say, then I've got to go to that to the parole board and ask them for my rights to enter into this contract. So they give me a paper saying that my civil rights are restored, to enter into this contract.
Do you own property?
Do I own property?
Right.
No, sir. I rent.
All right, we'll go out to Louisville, Kentucky. Mr. Abercrombie is hearing Night Call over WXVW-FM. Mr. Abercrombie?
Yeah.
Good evening, sir.
Who is it? Is this Rick?
No, this...
Mr. Crucci is on the line, and so is Del Shields.
Is this Al?
Yeah.
Hey, what are you doing, man? Long time no see.
Yeah, what's going on?
Oh, not much. Just sitting here taking life easy.
Can you take a phone number?
I guess I can.
Yeah.
Is it on the air?
It's on the air, so I would suggest that you call us back after the show, and we'll give you Mr. Klutsch's number.
Okay. All right, fine.
Good.
Thank you for calling, sir.
All right.
Thank you. Out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mr. Peterson is hearing Night Call over KGGM.
Oh,
Mr. Peterson?
Yeah. This is Jim Peterson. I'm state director of the Seven Step Foundation here in New Mexico.
Yes, Jim, how are you?
I'm fine, but we're not getting along so well.
You know,
because we're having trouble with fundraising.
We're having trouble with fundraising here too, man.
Trouble with fundraising. But the thing is, we're getting something going here. We've got a charter in the works. It's in the mill now. It's up in the State Corporation Commission, and it ought to be out before long. Bill Sands is going to be at Eastern New Mexico University in Portales on the 28th, 29th, and 30th of January.
Great.
Then he's going to go to Las Cruces on the 31st.
Good.
And we were wanting to do some fundraising in regard to a dinner in Santa Fe, where the state prison is. And we have the permission of the warden to take the seven steps into the pen with the
wonderful
class.
Did you do your time there, Jim?
Yeah, no, I done my time with Joe Wallace.
Oh, yeah.
In Lansing, Kansas, in the state penitentiary at Lansing, 6.5 years.
Well, maybe we could bring the barbed wire theater out there to New Mexico.
That's what I called you about. Could you do that?
Why, sure, why not?
Boy, that would be great.
Yeah. Mr. Peterson?
Yes?
Could you tell us a little bit about the seven-step program?
Yes, indeed I could. We have a program of seven steps, the first step of which is the most important step. It is facing the truth about ourselves, we decided, and the world around us. Facing the truth about ourselves and the world around us, we decided that we needed to change. Now, that's the first step. And if you'll notice, each step is started with the letter, and the letter, it spells out freedom, F-R-E-E-D-O-M. Freedom for the convict, freedom for the ex-convict. Our motto is happiness is a direction, not a place. In other words, no matter where you are, whether you're in prison or where you are, it's the direction you're heading that makes you happy. It's not being in prison. Anyway, the first step is facing the truth about ourselves and the world around us. We decide that we needed to change. And then the R is realizing that there is a power from which we can gain strength. We decided to use that power. And the third is evaluating ourselves by taking an honest self-appraisal. We examine both our strengths and our weaknesses. And then the fourth one is the other E, F-R-E-E. And the other E is, what is it, Rick? Rick?
Yes, sir.
What is the other E? Evaluating ourselves and endeavoring to overcome our weaknesses. We decide to use that power to help us overcome our weaknesses. And the D is deciding that our freedom is worth more than our resentments. We decided to use that power to help rid us of our resentments. And then the O is observing that daily progress is necessary. We set for ourselves an attainable goal towards which we can work each day.
Why don't you let me give the seventh one?
All right, why don't you, Rick?
Seventh is maintaining our own freedom. We promise to help ourselves as we help others as we've been helped.
And that's really most important. And I think Rick will agree that we stole those seven steps from the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
You did.
I'm also an alcoholic. And
whatever works, man, don't knock it.
No, it's all right.
Mr. Peterson.
I haven't had a drink in almost 20 years, but I've been out almost 12 and a half, well, over 12 and a half years now. And Joe Wallace helped me when I got out. And Joe Wallace is now national president of the Seven Step Foundation. And I wouldn't be here, I don't believe, without Joe Wallace and his wonderful wife, Bee. Does he know you're on the air tonight?
I wonder if Del, Jim, I wonder if Del realizes how many people move through through our national prison system each year. Del, do you know?
If you'll hold just a moment, we'll break for station identification, and Mr. Peterson, you may stay on the line if you'd like to.
All right, thank you.
Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest ex-con prison reformer Rick Clouchy after station identification. Night Call welcomes your comments about this nationwide listener call-in program. Your opinions and reactions are of value to the producers of Night Call in their continuing attempt to initiate and stimulate dialogue between the black man in the street and his white counterpart. Please address your comments to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. The producers of Night Call attempt to balance the points of view presented on this series about controversial issues. In keeping with this traditional concern for free expression on controversial matters, Night Call invites requests for equal time from responsible representatives on opposing points of view if it's thought they have not been adequately represented on the air. Such requests should be addressed to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Rick Clouchy, ex-convict turned prison reformer. He says you've got to reform the prisons before you can really reform the prisoners. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Dell Shields.
Mr. Peterson and Mr. Clucci, since both of you are on the line, I'd like to pose this question, and I would like your response. We just came out of a very heated political campaign where one of the big issues was law and order. And I know here in New York City, just a few weeks ago, there was a story in the New York Times that stated that many people who become, who are robbed, or who in some way become involved with criminals, they do not bother calling the police department because they feel the police department is helpless. Now, if those of us who are on the outside are becoming indoctrinated with the idea that law and order is a very big problem, and if there are many of us who believe that the police are helpless, how is it possible that we can attempt to talk about prison reform and attempt to try to help those who have been incarcerated?
Do you want to answer that, Rick?
Well, he's posing several good questions in one.
Yes, indeed.
And I think that, I just have to say, as citizens, as people who are concerned about not only our own rights, our civil rights, our human rights, our property, the rights of our friends, that we have to respond in the only way that we can as civilized people, and that is to take these problems to our law enforcement agencies.
And, absolutely.
And deal with it,
We got to trust the law.
We have to
have faith in the law.
Without law, we'd be in trouble.
Absolutely. And I have a reverence for the law since I got out of prison. That is why it's tremendous. I wouldn't think of doing anything to break the law to lose my freedom. I believe personally that I am more aware of the fact that there are laws that need to be kept and not broken than any square John that I know. Don't you, Rick?
That's right. But
I know what I'd get if I'd break a law, and that would be another one of those prison terms. And I've had three of them, and that's enough.
But we went to Europe, Dell. I think maybe part of your question here. We went to Europe, my wife and I, on a honeymoon. And during the course of our absence, we were robbed. Our apartment was robbed, and her book collection of some 17 years was taken and so on, things we couldn't replace. And so we were insured, but, routinely you have to contact the police, and we were more interested in recovery of the property than being paid on an insurance claim. Mm-hmm. So we took it all the way through to the police department. And when you say they're helpless, you're basically right, because unless someone is seen taking that property, you're pretty much at the mercy.
Yeah, I think we should think not only of the people that should be in prison, and that man certainly should be in prison, but we also should think about the victim of the thing, and I do believe that...
Well, if more people would care, Jim, I think...
More people would care.
More people would care
themselves.
You wouldn't need as many police.
And just say, but for the grace of God, there go I. Just say that, and you will gain wisdom and compassion by doing that. Believe me, boy,
in today's world we need
to have law and order.
We need communication too, Jim.
Certainly do.
Mr. Peterson?
We need more police community relations.
Mr. Peterson, thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you, sir, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Jim.
Bye-bye, Rick.
Thank you, sir. Out to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Mr. Rancrone is hearing Night Call over WTMJ. Mr. Rancrone?
Yes, sir. I don't have any question, but I'd just like to compliment you, Rick, on the fine job you're doing, and I hope that all of your future endeavors are successful as they have been.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay,
thank
bye, sir.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Ball is calling in from Louisville, Kentucky. He's hearing Night Call over WLRS-FM. Mr. Ball?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, I have a question or two, the way I interpret this program right now is that you want these prisons to become like a state hospital, true?
No, because what have the state hospitals produced?
Well, actually, that's what I can't understand. They haven't produced anything.
Yeah, well, I'm not even suggesting that.
Well, we have a reformatory in Kentucky, the Kentucky Reformatory for Men, which has no barbed wire, as you would call it, and the guards are unarmed, and... And actually, some of these guys, they have social workers there.
Right.
And they actually do, some of these hardened criminals, as you would call them, have escaped. And they can't seem to reform them. They've had doctors there, and they've worked with these people, and yet they still escape. And this is sort of dangerous in a way because they go roaming through the streets, you know.
But what percentage of these people would you be talking about, Mr.?
Now, it's a very low percent.
Right, right.
But there still is the man that would.
Sure, there's a problem. There's the same problem walking across the street or taking an airplane.
True.
But no guarantees. There's none in the Constitution, really.
No, but if you take a hardened criminal and let him out on the street, what could he do? He'd get in a tower in Texas and kill a few people.
Well, this is basically what is happening across in our penal system today anyway. Those so-called hardened criminals you're talking about are being released every day under the statutes of the very laws they were sentenced by.
Oh, I'll go along with you. I think the Supreme Court...
locking people up is not the answer. You see what I'm talking about? I suggest another approach. And when you talk about the experience of state hospitals versus prisons, any kind of institution is going to have its problem. And now all I am suggesting is when we tear these walls down and when we get rid of our punitive attitudes and when we start talking with people and reaching people and communicating with them with the best of our science and our technology and our humanity, and we start bringing some qualified people, humanists in, teachers in, doctors in, the force of our sociology, the force of our psychology, and the knowledge that our psychiatry brings about, then we are on solid ground. But we cannot limit this proposition to wholly professional people. We have got to open up this bag a little bit. You know, you've got a pretty big umbrella, so you've got to bring in new professionals. You've got to bring in cats who've had the experience. You've got to bring in former offenders. You've got to interest these institutions in programs that will work, and you've got to get a dialogue going between those people who've had the experience and have come out of it and have become successful and who can go back into those prisons and say, hey, look, guys, look, it's going to work, man. It's working for me. I don't care what you hear in here on the yard. I don't care what this scuttlebutt is in here. I'm here, man, and the only reason I'm here is because I've been there, right?
Right.
We start talking to these people from the context of knowledge and experience and respectability. You see, so that's what the barbed wire theater is all about. That's the whole premise of this, of bringing my play and plays that will be written by other inmates, and we're going into those prisons, the prisons which we formerly served time, and prisons all over this country if we can, and we're going to stand up on those stages and not show them a prison play. Yeah, we're going to show them a prison play. You know,
mm-hmm.
And that's this joint, man. This is the thing you're walking around in here. It's not a very nice place. Well, we didn't come 2,000 miles to tell you that. But what we did come to tell you is that you can make it.
Now, don't get me wrong.
You made it.
I have 2 points on this.
Go ahead.
I have one where I think that the prison should be reformed. I think that there should be an educational process in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And another point is I do believe in capital punishment. Now, I'm a conservative on this side because I've always felt that a person that has committed a sin like murder, premeditated murder, he should have to pay for it with his own life.
Yeah, I see what you
mean. Now, there are certain people, certain criminals, that are in prison, not from their own free will. You know what I'm talking about? They've had a raw deal in life, and they've gone the other way.
Yeah.
And I think they can be helped a lot. There are certain ones.
They're mental defectives, another percentage of them are. These are people who have no education, no ability to articulate their own problems, no communication with the world around them. And who are these people? Do you know who they are? They're not middle-class America, man. These guys are black people. These guys are brown people. These guys are way, way down on the social ladder. And these guys die in these places. Not the people who can afford a good defense attorney. Not the people who have any status or any education. You know, I'm looking at the congressional record right now. And here's the Honorable Philip Hart of Michigan. He goes on and on for 4 pages, diagrams, charts, everything, talking about, you know, what capital punishment is in our country and how we've used this, how we've used it, how these states have used this thing. How many juveniles were executed under these laws, you know? This is a ridiculous thing, you know?
Well, what do you think of Escobedo and Miranda?
You mean as far as the decisions go?
Yeah.
I think that, sure, you've got a pilot case, you've got a trial case there, so maybe a lot of people don't agree with that law. But that law had to be written, man. That law had to be written, you see, because it set that precedent.
But I don't think that people who look at it and say, "Hey, man, that's a weak law. That's a law that's going to, you know, cater to the criminal element. That's going to be a big loophole in our social framework of justice." No, no, I don't buy that. I think that law was necessary, and that there's got to be other new laws also necessary, and people were going to, you know, stand up on their hind legs about it. But these laws are necessary because of these changing times.
Well, I've been what you've known as a security officer on the, you know, working here and there and so forth, commissioned by the state of Kentucky. But on this Miranda case, for instance, or Escobedo, either one, where they define the constitutional rights, now I'm for that. But what about the man himself, the crime he did commit? Now, he got off on that.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
Now he's back in prison for, you know, he's gone out and done something else.
He's going to go back. You know, I mean, this is the thing. The people who, you know, God, we don't get too many laws changed every day, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And the ones that they do change, and when you get the concurrence of the Supreme Court on it, I think you've got a bunch of solid cats sitting up there, and they've certainly got an awful lot of law behind them. And when they make a decision like that, I don't care if the decision was split. They, you know, they're doing it with a great amount of experience and a great amount of humanity, and they can look at the world in which we live today and tell, you know, that some of these laws are not keeping pace with the people, with the needs of changes that are necessary.
Well, sir,
Mr. Ball,
you go. I appreciate talking to you, and I have to say one thing. I think it's a good idea. I like the reform idea, but let's take it slow and sure.
Hey, that's the only way.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Change with reason and intelligence, and change where it is necessary after it has been carefully thought out. Now, I am not referring on a general basis straight across the board either when I make that statement. I think things are, you know, a lot of things have to be changed, and they should be changed as soon as possible, you know.
Mr. Clucci will return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest ex-con prison reformer Rick Clucci after station identification. Monday night on Night Call. Is celibacy out of date for the Catholic priesthood? With married ex-priest James Kavanaugh. Did you know that all but one of the first bishops of the church were married? That St. Peter himself was married in Rome? And that it wasn't until the beginning of the 5th century that it was against church law for priests to marry? And that the reason for it was to keep the wealthy landowners of the day from marrying their daughters to priests and taking over the church? That in the 9th century the canonical law on celibacy was largely ignored? And that it wasn't until 1917 that the strongest church law on celibacy came into being? Is celibacy out of date for the Catholic priesthood? With married ex-priest James Kavanaugh, author of A Catholic Priest Looks at His Outdated Church, Monday night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Rick Clucci, ex-convict turned prison reformer. He says you've got to reform the prisons before you can really reform the prisoners. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we'll take our next call from New York City. Patrolman Knowles is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Patrolman Knowles?
Mr. Clucci?
Yes.
Mr. Clucci, I'm calling you to congratulate you and to tell you that I speak for many, many ex-convicts. And this may be surprising, not only to you, but to many listeners. I am a patrolman now. I was convicted as a youthful offender, and I served 2.5 years. Minor convictions considered non-felonies and misdemeanors are not supposed to be held against you. But I fought and had to fight very hard to get the position that I am now in. And the only
only way I was able to obtain it was through writing to the governor, who referred it to the clemency board. And in turn, they stated that I had no actual record since any crime that I committed was while I was underage.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to congratulate you.
Well, I want to congratulate you. And I want to give you a little information here at the same time. When you think about how hard you had to fight to get your rights restored and to get the record expunged to allow you to become an officer,
right.
Listen to this. This is a connection with the last question regarding the death penalty.
Right.
I'm quoting the congressional record. One little noticed fact is the age of those executed. Between
right.
1937 and 1964, 178 teenagers were executed. And we're talking about the United States.
That is pathetic.
11 of these were 16 and younger.
That is pathetic.
Including boys of 15 and 14.
It is really pathetic.
Just 12 years ago in 1954, quoting the date of this congressional record, 10 teenagers were executed, including one 16-year-old and two 17-year-olds. And Honorable Philip Hart from Michigan goes on to say here, and I'll just stop it. I believe our society is the poorer because the decision was made to kill these youths rather than to attempt to rehabilitate them.
That is really
unquote.
Pathetic. Rick, you know, I'd like to say this. I don't want to take up too much time, but I would like to say this. You know, society, what is known as society, says that we want rehabilitation. No one can rehabilitate an individual. He must rehabilitate himself.
That's right. And here's an interesting point, too. What is the meaning of the word rehabilitation? If you grab your dictionary, it says to return to a former state.
Exactly.
I grew up in the city of Chicago. I've been to two orphanages, a reform school.
Exactly.
I've been married before. I went to the Army. I took a bus ride to San Quentin for 12 years.
Exactly.
Now, where do you want to return me to?
Right, Rick. When you were in San Quentin, you could have very well mopped floors.
Yeah.
You could have taken menial jobs, but
right.
This was not what you wanted. The same with me. I did not want this.
Right.
I got my high school diploma. I learned and mastered radio and TV.
Beautiful.
And I studied music, which I can play now, the sax.
Beautiful.
And the clarinet. It's not necessary in my everyday line of work, but it was constructive. And as you say, spend this money that is wasted. Spend this money instead of guards and hardened sticks. Spend this money on psychiatrists. Spend this money on
right.
people who can
right.
do the work that is needed.
Right.
Don't waste the money. These men need help.
They're
storage
help. Houses. They're
human
warehouses
beings.
For human beings.
They are not animals. They are
That's
human
right.
beings and should be treated as such.
That's right. You know, they're dumping grounds, junkyards. That's the way I look at them.
You know,
there are cats sitting over there who couldn't be there today.
In the Daily News a few months ago, that in Sing Sing they were instituting a computer program to train men.
Beautiful.
Computer program.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. And they said that it has been an absolute success.
And it's got to be
one. So it shows. It shows that
sure.
evidently these men must be human beings and they must have some sort of intelligence. They cannot all be absolute idiots.
That's right. That's right.
Mr. Knowles,
yes.
How long have you been on the force?
2 years.
I see. One other question. You stated that you had a number of problems. Were you discouraged along the line in the attempts to get your record expunged?
Was I discouraged? I most certainly was discouraged. But I must say, I am black and I am proud. I was discouraged many times because I had many strikes against me. But, number one, I was a convict. Number two, I was black. This
now, add to that if you had one leg shorter than the other or you had a speech impediment. That's three strikes.
That's three.
Yeah, that's
right.
A big three.
That's right. So, therefore, society says one thing, but they mean another.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you so much.
We are human beings, like I am.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Good luck to you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck to you, Rick.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Night Call in New York, and before we return to our guest, Mr. Rick Clucci, calling in from San Francisco, we'll take a moment out to remind you about next week on Night Call.
Next week on Night Call, an ex-priest, now married, examines what he calls his outdated church. A psychoanalyst who says that one sign our modern age is dying is that our myths are disintegrating. The black mayor of Gary, Indiana, and the author of the provocative bestseller, The Rich and the Super Rich. Monday, James J. Kavanaugh, who came to prominence as the author of A Modern Priest, looks at his outdated church, examines his life since he left the Catholic priesthood and became a married man. Tuesday, we celebrate New Year's Eve by taking the night off. Wednesday, Dr. Rollo May, the psychoanalyst, who says myths are a clue to reality, and our present myths haven't got very much to do with present reality. Thursday, Mayor Richard Hatcher of Gary, Indiana, reports on his first year in office. And Friday, Ferdinand Lundberg, author of The Rich and the Super Rich, or Who Really Owns America? All this next week on Night Call. Again, Del Shields.
We'll take our next call from Rochester, New York. Mr. Tarantelli is hearing Night Call of WROC-FM. Mr. Tarantelli?
Hello. My question is this. Up till now, you've been talking exclusively about rehabilitation of the person who has already committed a crime. But now, if you remove the punitive factor completely, what happens to the deterrent factor? What happens to all those possibly millions of people who are restrained from committing crimes solely out of fear of the consequences?
Well, you raise an excellent point, and I don't pretend to know, you know, how to deal with it. And I only offer the alternative of a strong move toward a more human system of dealing with the male factor. Now, when you come up with a question like that, I think that the deterrent value, the quote unquote, you know, the ritual, the symbolism of punishment for a bad deed, is brought up on the familial level or brought into the people, young people, and that when we allow our young people more voice. Not toward permissiveness, this isn't where I'm going. I'm talking about more of the decision-making things that young people can be brought into, more representation in their own futures and the decisions that decide where they go and who they become and what they want to be. And this strikes at the educational system again, too, so that when you reach out to people, young people, and you give them educational programs, And you know you don't have the aspect or the shadow of a nuclear war over their heads, and you know the whole question of these mind expanding drugs, the question of clothes, of long hair and beards, and this whole beat movement. You're not going to stop it. You know, you can't contribute to it either. But what you can do is cause a holding action by coming up with good programs. Programs that appeal to these people, programs that represent these people, and I think that when we build for our future, providing God lets us have one, then we've got to do it by reaching the young people, because they are the future. And that's why I'm so strong about taking this play, The Cage, in the Barbed Wire Theater, to our universities and to our high schools and to our community centers and our parks and our summer camps. And to let these guys who have served this time and have had these unique human experiences tell these people what these problems are. We're not going to educate them. Man, we're not going to sermonize them. We're just going to communicate. We got a dialogue going. We got a thing going that they dig and that they can understand. And we're just expanding their human base.
Mr. Tarantelli, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation, Reforming Our Prisons and Our Prisoners, and our guest, we want to thank so very much, Mr. Rick Clucci, for calling in from San Francisco. We want to thank you for being with us, and certainly wish you the very best, and of course, a very happy new year.
Well, thank you very much, Del.
Thank you so much for being with us. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night, and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Monday night, same time, same station, is Celibacy Out of Date for the Catholic Priesthood with married ex-priest James Cavanaugh. Listen Monday night, discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.